Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Not for the first time since Inauguration Day, one is obliged to ask, this time about trade and tariffs in this economy. Now, what happens? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, March the 5th, good as always to have you along, everybody. We're going to start today with a trade package, how those proposed tariffs might work or not, and we're going to do it because macroeconomics, right? To quote Adam Smith, if a foreign country can supply us with a commodity cheaper than we ourselves can make it, better buy it of them. That is from The Wealth of Nations, as it happens. And with that, we go to Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross talking to Chuck Todd on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday morning about those steel and aluminum tariffs that the president has proposed.
Whatever his final decision is what will happen.
Meaning this isn't a done deal.
I didn't say that. I just said what he has said, he has said. If he says something different, it'll be something different. I have no reason to think he's going to change.
So that was Chuck's giggle there, not mine. Yesterday, of course, from the cabinet officer responsible for executing trade policy, today in the Oval Office, President Trump said he is 100% his word going ahead with the tariffs, not backing down, he said, although he did add that even though the tariffs have been announced, they are still actually not yet written down anywhere. This is not the way trade policy usually works, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Typically, the tariff process starts with a U.S. industry complaining to the Commerce Department that an international competitor is dumping its products in the U.S. at unfairly low prices or being unfairly subsidized by its home country, say through tax breaks. Harry D. Gorder teaches international trade policy at Cornell. He says the Commerce Department evaluates the claim.
Are there subsidies? Is there dumping?
If Commerce decides there is, the case goes to another U.S. agency, the International Trade Commission. It decides if the U.S. industry was hurt by unfair competition. If so, DeGorder says the offending country gets a warning from the U.S.
You have 90 days to smarten up.
Then if things don't change in 90 days, the president can levy a tariff. But normally that doesn't happen until various government agencies have been consulted and warned the White House of unintended consequences of any tariffs. Phil Levy teaches international business strategy at Northwestern.
They all get together and try to at least present the president with well-thought-out options. That's the standard procedure for doing this.
After that procedure, the new tariff policy is written out by White House lawyers and formally announced by the president. Obviously, President Trump didn't do that. Carla Hills was U.S. Trade Representative in the George H.W. Bush administration.
He's using procedures that are rarely used.
Hill says just look at the section of trade law President Trump turned to for his steel and aluminum tariffs. It justifies tariffs in the interest of national security. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, so here's a trade policy what if. What if you're an American trading partner and you are, shall we say, miffed about these tariffs, as the Europeans and the Canadians clearly are. We know that because they've told us. You could fire back directly, tit for tat, or you could find ways to retaliate under the agreed-upon rules that the world has had in place for more than 20 years, those of the World Trade Organization. In fact, though, a lot of people are thinking the WTO and that whole system of rules is about to face a big test of legitimacy, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
You block my steel, I block your Kentucky bourbon. Okay, I'll tax your BMWs. Now, the WTO is meant to calm all this down. It has rules limiting when you can impose tariffs. The beef here is that the U.S. plans steel tariffs on grounds of national security. Jennifer Hillman at Georgetown Law says the WTO only allows national security tariffs in certain cases.
Relating to fissionable materials, meaning does this relate to nuclear things, relating to traffic in arms or ammunitions or implements of war. So hard for me to see how necessarily the United States is going to win.
So other countries are crying WTO abuse. Now, they could sue in WTO court, which takes 3 years or more. Another option is to strike back faster with their own tariffs, which the WTO allows in certain cases. Edward Alden is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
Because other countries, and the Europeans have been pretty explicit about this, believe that this action is an egregious violation, they're far more likely to retaliate rather quickly.
And President Trump has counter-tweeted that he would then restrict European cars. Walls could go up everywhere, which is what the WTO was created to prevent. Now, if the steel tariffs are challenged in WTO court and the U.S. wins, other countries could copycat. India, for instance, could block our grain to protect its national security, says trade lawyer Lynn Fisher-Fox at Arnold & Porter.
If this rationale stands up for steel and aluminum, then their rationale of food security likely stands up as well.
If the U.S. loses at the WTO, President Trump could walk away from the global rules entirely, which, by the way, the U.S. helped to write in the first place. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
One of the justifications for those tariffs from the Trump administration, other than the stated one of national security that Scott and Nancy were talking about, is that the White House wants to protect American jobs, it says. The jobs have been lost here because other countries have been dumping low-cost metals onto the global market. Those opposed to the tariffs say many more jobs could be lost in industries that use metal to make things like cars and appliances, industries that would, in theory, have to pay higher prices for their steel and aluminum. Who's right? We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to dig into that one.
We'll start by comparing U.S. jobs in steel and aluminum production that Trump's tariffs aim to protect and jobs that could be at risk from higher metal prices in industries like autos and machinery and aerospace. Here's Douglas Holtz-Aiken at the American Action Forum.
You are potentially harming a large number, 6 million or so, for some 140,000 or so steelworkers.
The 140,000 steel and aluminum production workers number comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The 6 million plus metal-using workers is from Moody's Analytics. Josh Bivens at the Economic Policy Institute says this trade-off's worth it in the short run to help U.S. manufacturing workers who've been slammed by unfair global competition.
I think we're going to actually protect some steel jobs. Plants that would have shuttered and people that would have been laid off will get some breathing room.
Mark Goodfellow is the president of Steelworkers Local 420 in Messina, New York, where one of Alcoa's last remaining aluminum smelters is still operating with about 500 workers.
Excitement. There's nothing but pure excitement over this. Now it feels like we have a chance to compete.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken says even if some jobs are added in steel and aluminum, it's not likely to be a lot. He grew up in Pittsburgh. His father ran a steel mill, now closed and bankrupt.
And that mill's not going to come back if we put in steel tariffs. And the mills that do come back are going to look dramatically different.
With a lot of sophisticated automation and fewer workers on the factory floor. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Last week, the prospect of tariffs was Wall Street kryptonite. If you remember, today, tariffs? What tariffs? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The National Rifle Association, in most of its public impressions, comes across as a big national-level political lobbying group, which it is. But a lot of what the NRA actually gets done policy-wise happens at the state level. One state in particular, Florida. The NRA's successes there and the woman responsible for them are the subject of a new piece in the New Yorker magazine by Mike Spees. He writes about 78-year-old Marion Hammer, who he and others call the most influential gun lobbyist in the country, for the past 40 years. Concealed carry and stand your ground laws all started in Florida under Hammer's guidance. Mike Spees, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Kai.
One of the things about Marion Hammer that struck me in this piece was that it's pretty explicit by those who've been on the receiving end of her lobbying efforts that she's playing the long game, that state legislators in Florida are there for 2, 4, 6 years, and she's going to be around for a long time, and she will keep whittling away at these issues.
Right. You know, there are times when she does, you know, she has dealt setbacks when she introduces a bill, or she has, I should say, a lawmaker introduce a bill. Sometimes
that was,
it gets hung.
That was an interesting slip of the tongue, though, right?
Right.
Because that's
right,
kind of the name of the game in this piece, is that she is active to the point of authorship of a lot of the legislation, the gun legislation that's been happening in Florida.
Yeah, she's generally using lawmakers in Florida as her proxies. I mean, she's a lobbyist, not a lawmaker, so she's not literally allowed to file a bill and to vote on it. So she needs a member to do that. but she's behind the policy and she's overseeing its development throughout the entire process.
You know, somebody in this piece points out that one email from Marion Hammer to NRA supporters and members in the state of Florida can be worth more than like 100,000 television ad buys in terms of political influence. And with that in mind, and with the acknowledgement that there is a substantial amount of money at play in Florida here, NRA money, talk to me about Governor Rick Scott, who is rumored to be running for or thinking about running for the Senate down there this fall, who pays attention to what Marion Hammer says. It all kind of plays into that.
Yeah, and he in particular owes a lot. It was a great debt to her because when he, you know, when he took office or he was running first in 2010, he was a complete political neophyte. He'd never held office before. He had no legislative history to speak of. And in the primary that year, the NRA, Marion specifically, gave him a big boost, effectively endorsing him over his primary opponent. And then going forward in 2014, when he was up for re-election, the NRA did spend quite a lot of money helping to re-elect Rick Scott. And he's, of course, until now, never taken a position remotely contrary to anything that she's asked for.
And we should say in the wake of Parkland that Governor Scott has seemed at least more amenable to some kind of gun control legislation in the state of Florida.
That's right. Yeah. What's happening right now where he's, even though these things he's asking for are fairly modest, like raising the minimum age limit to purchase a long gun from 18 to 21 or mandating 3-day waiting periods for all gun purchases. These aren't, you know, they're not major policy reforms in the way that banning assault weapons might be, but they are still contrary to what Marion is calling for. So that does, I mean, this is, you know, we're in uncharted territory when it comes to that.
Mm-hmm. How much has Marion Hammer been able to capitalize both in terms of political funding, but also an influence in this idea of gun ownership in this country being part of a group identity, and then that having such sway that people will respond to her pleas for money and or emails to legislators and people in position to do something about this?
She's gotten a huge amount of mileage out of that concept, and I think, you know, she's one of the originators of that concept, which now, I mean, that's an idea the NRA sells in general to its members. But she's been cultivating this us against them mindset since the 80s. So, you know, when she raises some issue, perhaps like a Republican lawmaker has voted the wrong way on something and, you know, broken with the flock, she's taught hundreds of thousands, if not nearly 2 million people, to immediately respond to her requests. And that means emailing them, emailing the governor's office, telling them to not do the bad thing that they're about to do or undo the bad thing that they have done. And that always results in many thousands of emails. And it's she's proven that she can mobilize those people so effectively that everyone is not only aware of it, but it's to some extent afraid of it. It's her leverage.
I imagine gun rights advocates and NRA supporters in other states now look to Florida for how to do their policy, how to get their policy goals met.
Yeah, I mean, she's the example. I mean, you can't really find a more successful, there is no more successful, especially state gun lobbyist. I mean, the NRA's got its state lobbying apparatus, I think, consists of, I don't know, 15 or 16 lobbyists on staff, and a lot of them actually work out of the headquarters in Virginia, and they're responsible for a few different states, and they fly out to them when major policy issues come up, and then they go back to Virginia. But Marion is the rare lobbyist who's stationed in the state in which she lobbies, and over four decades, she's just managed to insinuate herself into the legislature. I mean, she's not part of the government, but in a lot of ways, she's very much part of the government.
Mike Spies writes for The Trace. His piece on the Florida NRA and Marion Hammer in particular was published in the New Yorker magazine. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up,
I think the definition of what a movie is, at least at major Hollywood studios make, has really fundamentally changed.
Lights, camera, box office. Straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers.
There you go. Dow Industrial's up 336 points, 1.3%, 24,874. NASDAQ gained 72 points, 1%, 7330. S&P 500 up 29 points, 1.1%, 27 and 20. Tariffs, what tariffs? Walmart moved up 1 3/10% today. The retailer is expanding its meal kit service into 2,000 of its stores. Can you guess what I'm going to say next? Come on, come on. Time's running short. Blue Apron, the meal kit company, off 5 1/10% today. Banks were on a roll. Citigroup improved 1%. Wells Fargo gained 0.3%. Bank of America grew about 1.5%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.88%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, it's not every day a corporate merger gets caught up in the national security apparatus, but today is, in fact, one of those days. The deal in question is Singapore-based Broadcom's $117 billion hostile takeover bid for chipmaker Qualcomm. They are out of San Diego. It would be the biggest tech deal ever, should it go through. The national security apparatus at play here is the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, CFIUS in the vernacular, which is interested apparently because both companies make wireless and radio chips that are essential to phones, Internet of Things, and eventually next generation 5G wireless technology. Molly Wood is the host of Marketplace Tech. She is here live on the phone to make me smart on all of this stuff. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So explain to me the national security apparatus part of this thing. What's going on?
That does seem like the important part. Broadcom is based in Singapore, and Qualcomm reportedly has some sensitive contracts with the government. And this is not unprecedented. The U.S. has previously barred Chinese companies like Huawei and ZTE from, in some cases, selling phones in the U.S. or, most saliently, building wireless infrastructure because of fears about spying or eavesdropping. And that is kind of fundamentally the national security part. There's been a raging debate, actually, for a few weeks within CFIUS, that Foreign Investment Committee, about whether to review this deal.
Is it normal, though, for it to be up for review sort of before things get signed on the dotted line? I mean, there's a lot of things going on here.
Yeah. And this is, you know, this is probably the most BuzzFeed semiconductor acquisition conversation that's like, because you guys will not believe how not normal this is. You know, the Committee on Foreign Investment sometimes gets involved in investments in companies right. that exist in other countries. But there seems to be no precedent for it investigating a hostile takeover before that takeover happens. And it is it has everything to do with that sort of level of security concern. A group of senators, a bipartisan group of senators, including John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, had asked this committee to weigh in. Huh. The committee falls under the U.S. Treasury Department, you know, Secretary Steve Mnuchin, who
yes.
I believe you know.
Yes, we have a chat.
Part of what made this a little bit awkward for the committee and the Trump administration is that President Trump had actually announced in November that Broadcom would move its headquarters to the U.S. from Singapore,
right.
Bringing about $20 billion dollars in investment to the U.S., which it really touted as a victory.
Right. There was a whole thing in the Oval Office or in the White House anyway, where the president welcomed the CEO of Broadcom. Talk to me, though, about something you said a minute ago. Wireless infrastructure, 5G, these chips. I want my whiz-bang fancy new stuff as fast as I can possibly get it. Is that what's on the line here?
That is on the line, and also who wins in the race to 5G. You know, this is next generation wireless technology right. that will power, you know, the Internet of Things. It'll get wireless broadband to rural areas. It will allow cars to talk to each other and roads so that they can eventually be driverless. You know, it is essentially the next internet. So you can imagine, if you think about the number of businesses that were created on the back of the internet, 5G right. is so important. But back in January, the Trump administration sort of casually floated the idea, you know, that the U.S. should right, nationalize right. a 5G network. And now they're concerned that China will jump ahead because, you know, in part, it's a little complicated, but Broadcom would have to sell off huge parts of Qualcomm in order to make this deal work. And that could actually set the combined company behind when it comes to competition from, and we go all the way back to the beginning, Huawei. In China.
Right, right. So super quick, we got like 15 seconds. If this deal gets stopped, 5G in the United States could be in peril. Is that what I hear you saying?
If the deal goes through, there's concern that 5G in the United States could be in peril. Yeah.
All right. Molly Wood, she's the host of Marketplace Tech, and with me, a podcast that we do together coming back soon called Make Me Smart. Molly, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
The Academy Awards last night was about a lot of things, right? This moment, obviously, with Me Too and Time's Up. Artistry, of course, and the making of movies that say something. But also, although this was more honored in the breach than anything else, the business of making money in the movies. Thing is, most of the movies honored last night aren't the movies that Hollywood's big studios are really making too much anymore. The franchise blockbusters that bring in gazillions of dollars. They, arguably, are the future of Hollywood, and they are what Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Fritz writes about in his new book. It is called The Big Picture. Ben, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Why did Hollywood stop doing business the way it used to do business, right? Because it's just different now.
It's fundamentally different now, Kai. Yeah, it's really a franchise and brand-driven business. There's the globalization of the business.
That international box office thing, right?
Yeah, international box office is so much bigger. And think about it, when you're trying to make a movie that's going to be appealing to people in Kansas City and Moscow and Shanghai and Rio, it really can't be too specific. So big visual effects, exciting films are much more appealing, as are brands you know. You want to get people out of the home, go into the theater, give them a brand they know. Just like we all like Apple, maybe people like Gucci. They also like Fast and Furious, and they like Marvel. And you combine that with the plunging DVD sales that we've seen and the rise of great television when there's not a lot of good reason to leave your living room. That results in what we got now.
Am I going too far if I say that franchises killed the movies?
The movies as we used to think of them,
yes.
I think the definition of what a movie is, at least that major Hollywood studios make, has really fundamentally changed.
You know, it's interesting. Somewhere in the middle of this book, you talk about Rain Man.
Yeah.
Which, you know, won the Academy Award, two huge stars, awesome film. Mm-hmm. Would not get made today.
No major studio would make Rain Man. It's an original idea. It's driven by movie stars, and it's a domestic film.
Who is this a problem for, right? Because the studios are making money. You know, Star Wars is printing money for Disney, right?
Yep.
Is it a problem for consumers or who? Because it's not the studios, right? Studios are happy.
Well, it's a problem for some studios, Kai, right? There's only a few studios that are really winning at this game, the new game of Hollywood. That's certainly Disney. They own Star Wars. They own Marvel. They own Pixar. I'd say Universal is getting into this business pretty well. They've caught up pretty successfully. They own Fast and Furious. They own Despicable Me. All the other studios to varying degrees are trying to catch up to that. So even studios that used to be hugely successful, like Sony, which is a big example in my book, they don't own many big franchises. That's why they've been struggling near the bottom of the box office for essentially almost a decade.
You do talk about Sony a lot in this book. You use the hacked emails for a lot of the source material. And I guess we know what happened inside Sony because of those emails. I wonder what emails in like Disney would look like or Warner Brothers.
That's a great question.
I'm sure you wonder too.
I would love to know
or
too.
Warner Brothers.
Yeah, you'd love to know. I think some of the same issues that Sony's been struggling with are the same issues any studio would. They were just more extreme at Sony because they were very successful at the game of dramas featuring movie stars like Will Smith and Adam Sandler. Yeah. They were very successful back when that won. But all the studios have dealt with this to varying degrees, except Disney. And so for them, their emails might just be a matter of what to do with all the profits that are pouring in.
We should all have such problems.
Yes.
As you watched the Oscars last night, you saw one of the cutaways of the crowd, and I'm thinking specifically here of Bob Iger, who runs Disney.
Yeah.
What do you think was running through his mind as he debates this acquisition of Fox Studios, as he sees none of his Disney movies up for the big awards? What's he thinking?
You know, I interviewed Bob Iger for the book, and I think what he's thinking as he watches this is a great show. I like the movies. You know, it's good for my ABC network, but totally irrelevant to my business.
Wow.
You know? When I interviewed him, the movie Spotlight had won Best Picture recently. He said, I love that film. It was great. But films like that are not a good business. And he said, I'm a businessman. And the movies that are good businesses are Marvel, are Black Panther, are Star Wars, are Pixar. And, you know, you could say on the one hand that's sad because the diversity of films we used to get are shrinking. On the other hand, the profits made by Disney's movie studio right now are higher than anyone has ever seen in the movie business. They're talking margins of about 30% per year for Disney's movie studio, whereas what's typical is like 10%.
Ben Fritz writes for The Wall Street Journal on Hollywood and life out here. His new book about the movies is called The Big Picture. Ben, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of things you didn't know you needed, spotted at grubstreet.com. An update to Pizza Hut's big tech innovation of last year, which was a pair of Bluetooth-enabled sneakers with a button on them that you could press to order pizza.
which is fine, I suppose, right? The update is another button that will let you pause your television for when your pizza delivery gets to your house. I've got two questions. Number one, doesn't your remote have a button on it that does the same thing, pause your TV? And number two, shouldn't Pizza Hut just spend the R&D money to make their pizza taste better? Don't at me about the Pizza Hut thing, all right? All right, the Dow up 336 today, 1.3%. NASDAQ up 72, 1%. S&P 500 up 1.1%, 29 points. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.